welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back tomorrow. And this is your call. So 40 years ago, on August 3rd, 1981, air traffic controllers all across the United States went on strike and threatened to shut down the skies. There were 13,000 of them, to be exact, and they were members of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, also known as PATCO. The PATCO members were demanding an annual wage increase, upgrades to outdated equipment, and a reduced work week. Shortly after the PATCO members walked out, then-President Ronald Reagan went on national television to tell the striking air traffic controllers that if they didn't get back to work within 48 hours, he would fire them. 2 days later, 11,345 federal air controllers were fired. Historian Joseph McCartan calls the 1981 strike and the defeat of PATCO one of the most important events in recent labor history. He says it inspired corporate America to fight unions harder than at any time since the 1930s. Today, 40 years after the PATCO strike, only 6% of private sector workers are unionized, roughly a third of what it was in 1981. McCartan says that as unions have declined, inequality has just grown more extreme. Joseph McCartan is professor of history at Georgetown University, where he's founding executive director of the Kalmanowitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. Joseph is an expert on U.S. labor, social, and political history, and his books include Labor's Great War, The Struggle for Industrial Democracy and the Origins of Modern American Labor Relations, and Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. Professor McCartan joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ethan. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you on. And I wanted to start by asking how you're thinking about the state of inequality in the United States today. We know that the pandemic has really worsened inequality. It's caused about 74 million people to lose work, the majority of whom were already making below average wages. And meanwhile, the collective wealth of the 650 billionaires in the United States jumped by over $1 trillion. So what are your reflections about where we are right now as a country in terms of economic inequality?
Well, you framed it, I think, perfectly. Where we are is that we've come out of a period of almost 40 years now of increasing inequality. And the pandemic just took that trend and put it on steroids to the point where the billionaires, as you say, have seen their fortunes grow astronomically since the pandemic hit. And those who have been hit hardest by the pandemic are the poor and the working poor. And there's no doubt that the pandemic has exacerbated what has been a long-standing problem that we've been struggling with. And I do believe it's a problem that is rooted in our workplace, in the decline of worker power in our workplaces. And I trace a lot of that back to the PATCO event and the impact that it had. Although it was focused on some federal workers, and as you say, we're talking about less than 12,000 of them that were fired as a result of this action. What happened to them, I think, ramified just really broadly through the economy and has helped to lay the groundwork for what we're going through right now.
Well, and your book really details a lot of the drama leading up to the strike and then the strike itself and the aftermath, especially for those workers. And I want to get into those details, but I wanted to pick up on something else that you just mentioned, which is that this has been a longstanding challenge of economic inequality in this country. And we know that for most workers, wages have barely budged in decades. The federal minimum wage hasn't been raised in 12 years, and more companies are turning to contractors to avoid paying employee benefits. Can you explain how we got here?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's occurred is what you referred to in the use of contractors and what's related to that. I would focus on a couple of things, although there are many other causes one could cite. One is privatization, and I think that that's inherent in your question. The shifting of jobs from public to private sector, which was one thing that Reagan really pushed forward very aggressively, helped to introduce higher levels of competition, and those pressed down on working standards quite a bit. At the same time, we saw the development of a process that the economist David Weil has called the fissuring, of the American workplace. And what he means by that is the movement of many private sector jobs out of core firms and increasingly subcontracted, the use of subcontracting, the use of franchising, the use of temporary workers. All these things have destabilized the employment relationship and helped to create a situation for many workers today where the person who signs their paycheck, their direct employer, isn't often the person who really calls the shots. Often that person is dictated to by the contract they have with a larger entity. And so over time what's developed is it's become harder and harder for workers to not only organize collectively, but then even if they are successful in organizing, being able to sit across from the bargaining table from those who really have the power to change things for the better for them. So it's a lot of different things that have come together over this last 40 years to create this inequality, but those are a couple of key features.
Well, and you reference the role of contractors as opposed to employees as one of the issues that's undermining potentially economic equality in this country. And we've certainly seen that play out here in California with gig workers in the Uber, Lyft, DoorDash economy. And in California, we've had the fallout from Proposition 22, which was an effort by these companies to try to keep these contractors essentially in that type of classification as opposed to giving them the full employee benefits. And I'm wondering if you've been following this Prop 22 debate. It's now on hold because of a court decision, but wondering if you've been following it and have thoughts about how that plays into the larger trends that we're seeing.
Yeah, I do. And I think that California had made great strides to try to deal with this problem of the transformation of so many workers into so-called, independent contractors. That's the model that that Lyft and Uber run on. It's the model that a lot of employers have adopted to basically put people in a category where they're no longer covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. You're right. When minimum wage hasn't been raised in so long, the minimum wage is broken, but it's broken even more because so many workers are categorized as being outside of its parameters. They're not even deemed to be employees. And I think the effort by the major gig employers like Uber to put forward Prop 22 and to try to ensconce into law a way of dealing with these workers that they deem favorable was really dangerous, and they flooded the field with advertisements to help push that proposition across the line. I'm glad that it's now held up in the courts. I believe that that legal challenge should stop it, but I think California's been on the forefront of trying to deal with this problem.
And I should note that it's still early in those court proceedings, but the issue is actually that the ballot initiative had a requirement that any modifications from the legislature require a 7/8 majority, super majority from the legislature to change it. And so that calls into account the constitutionality of that proposition. So we'll see how that particular initiative plays out in the court system here in California. But there is this larger trend about the decline of union membership. And according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the percentage of workers who are members of unions today is only about 10.8% compared to 1983, when the union membership rate was over 20%. And there were 17.7 million union workers. And a lot of young people today might have parents who are unionized, but they aren't themselves. So what does that say about the way that work in the United States has changed and the quality of employment in the United States?
Well, I think I would say almost the most important development for workers over the past 40 years has been that they have less and less power in the workplace, less bargaining power. This is especially so for younger folks, as you point out, and for those who are working in parts of the economy that have been growing quickly, like some of those gig employees. I think the lack of power for workers, which is one way to think about what it means to go from 20% unionization to 10%. That it's really a measurement of the decline of worker power. And as worker power, worker ability to demand a fair share of growing productivity declines, inequality just rages. And that's basically what we've seen in a nutshell over the past 40 years is because of declining worker ability to make demands of employers and to get employers to deliver them a bigger share of rising productivity. This is what's been the rocket fuel for the inequality we've seen.
And at the same time, we have seen a wave of worker uprisings across the country that have taken place during the pandemic. For example, Nabisco workers are currently on strike in five states, spanning from Colorado to Virginia. This summer, Frito-Lay workers in Topeka, Kansas, went on strike and ended up winning pay raises. And then there were the Amazon workers in Alabama, who ultimately voted more than 2-1 against unionizing, which got a lot of headlines at the time. But now they might get a do-over after a federal labor official said that Amazon's anti-union tactics have tainted the results. So what are you seeing now about the organizing movement across the United States? Is the trajectory changing now?
Well, I think there are certainly some promising signs that it is changing for the better in terms of worker bargaining power and worker ability to stand up and engage in collective action. And I want to come back to that point a little more later because I think those strikes like the one now going on at Nabisco are really important. But, you know, I think what we've seen in the aftermath of the pandemic, Ethan, is that there is a growing sense of workers that they don't want to return to status quo ante. They don't want to return to the way their jobs were and the way the economy was organized on the eve of the pandemic. It wasn't working for so many workers. One way I think that this is being evidenced is in the fighting back by workers like those at Nabisco. Another way it's evidenced, I think, is in the way that there's been this phenomenon we read about over the summer called the Great Resignation. So many workers have left jobs over the past a few months and aren't flocking back to jobs that are paying less than $15 an hour, that employers are starting to feel some pressure to improve wages if they're going to attract workers back. So I think all of that is promising, but it takes place in the context of, you know, 40 years of worker collective power being weakened. This, I think, is one of the legacies of the PATCO strike, because it was the PATCO strike that really sent the message to business in the 1980s to take on the union movement, and especially to take on that key tool that the Nabisco workers are now using, the tool of the strike. And it was after PATCO that you really saw employers go all out to break strikes in a way they hadn't done since the 30s. They were largely successful in doing that. And I would say that it's not only then the decline of union members we've seen over time that you point out from 20 to 10%, but even more indicative, I think, of declining worker power is the declining use of the strike by workers, because so many strikes were broken in the aftermath of PATCO that it became increasingly dangerous for unions and workers to engage in strikes. Strikes atrophied over time as a tool for workers. And that's why I think that the what's happening in Nabisco and some of the other examples you cited is a really important revival at this moment. I don't see workers turning the corner toward rebuilding an economy that works for them. I don't see that happening without collective action beginning to find more success than it's found in recent decades.
Well, these are really important points, and even despite the hardships of the pandemic, I think it does seem like it's potentially creating the conditions for a reset for many workers who are now saying they're not going to return to the workplace unless wages are raised and conditions are improved. And I think this really does bring us up to the air traffic controller strike, which you have written extensively about in your new book, Collision Course. I just want to let listeners know that you're listening to Your Call. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we're very pleased to be joined by Joseph McCartan, professor of history at Georgetown University and author of the book Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. We do want to hear from you, and have you, our listener, join the conversation if you have questions about the future of labor in America or about the air traffic controller strike, which we'll get into in just a minute. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send emails, any thoughts or questions you have, to yourcall@kalw.org or comment on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. So let's get into the air traffic controller strike. Can you just remind us what the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization was and how the union first formed? Because it's a pretty remarkable story that you write about in the book to great detail. I mean, it involves Johnny Carson, F. Lee Bailey. How did all this come together?
It's a really fascinating and in many ways unusual story, but it's also a story that's very indicative of what was happening in post-war America. By the 50s, you know, the union movement that had emerged in the 30s in mass production industries had done a pretty successful job of winning things for its members. This helped to inspire an increasing number of public sector workers, workers for the federal, the state, and local governments to think they needed union rights, and they needed to organize as well. So you start to see this spirit beginning to take root by the end of the 50s in all kinds of government workplaces. There was one particular government workplace that was really under a lot of stress at that moment, and that was the nation's air traffic control centers and towers, the people who worked for the Federal Aviation Administration, the federal agency. They're highly skilled people who directed air traffic in and out and between airports around the country. They were working with antiquated equipment. They were doing mandatory overtime. They were really under terrible stress. And then this horrific event happened over New York City on December 16, 1960, in which two airplanes came together in a mid-air collision, killing hundreds, both in the sky and on the ground. One of the planes landed in Park Slope in Brooklyn. And this horrific event really galvanized New York area controllers to say, we need an organization. They started to organize. As it happened, the Kennedy administration was just coming in at that time. Kennedy had promised the union movement he would bring some collective bargaining rights to federal workers, and he issued an executive order in January of 62 that offered limited collective bargaining for federal workers. PATCO emerges in response to that opportunity. So it took them several years, though, to form the union. It wasn't finally formed until 1968. The famous trial lawyer, F. Lee Bailey, you referenced, who was probably known to some listeners because of his involvement in defending O.J. Simpson in that famous trial of the 90s. He was a pilot himself. He became interested in the plight of these people, and he helped them start their union. They're formed in that tumultuous year of 68, and they actually engaged in a number of collective actions almost from the beginning, not strikes, but slowdowns and efforts to try to pressure their employer to improve their conditions, their equipment, to hire new controllers. They made a lot of progress with their union, just as other public employee unions were starting to make progress in the late 60s and early 70s. You know, the Memphis sanitation strike that Martin Luther King supported. This is a big breakthrough for local government workers around the country. Teachers are beginning to organize. So PATCO was part of that wave and emerged from that same wave of public sector organizing.
And I should clarify, I said that it's a new book, Collision Course. It actually came out in 2011, but it's very relevant to today. So I think it feels very new in that sense. But I appreciate the history of PATCO and how that came together. That takes us up to the strike in 1981 after Reagan was in office. So can you describe what was going on with that strike? What did PATCO workers want? And what exactly were their demands there in 1981?
Well, it's a great question. Before actually getting there, I should say some things about what happened prior to that. Actually, this union did engage in collective action. And in 1970, about 3,000 air traffic controllers staged what in effect was a strike, though they called it a sick out. They demanded some reforms. The government came down pretty hard on them. But it only ended up firing one air traffic controller in the long run. It tried to fire about 100 at first. It later reduced that number and only ended up firing one. The union made some gains coming out of that, and that was under Richard Nixon even, but no great friend of unions. So the union had learned from the beginning that we really only can make progress with this really stubborn employer when we flex our muscles a little bit. Over the course of the 70s, they did this a few more times in slowdowns and other efforts to win improvements from the FAA. But over time, by the end of the 70s, they were coming to the conclusion that they could really not get the federal government to address the deep-seated problems in the nation's air traffic control centers, and that they might have to, you know, use the ultimate weapon of an all-out strike of the entire controller workforce, which was about a little over 14,000 air traffic controllers by the end of the 70s. The union was really strong. There was over 90% dues-paying membership in the nation's control towers, even though actually to this day the federal government is an open shop where nobody's required to be a union member, but the union was so effective fighting for controllers, it had this strong base. And the base came to believe, you know, we're not getting the change and the reform we really need. They became really frustrated with Jimmy Carter, who came in 1977. His administration proved to be a harder bargaining partner than the previous administrations had been. And so the union became so disillusioned that it actually endorsed Ronald Reagan against Carter in 1980. And then with the hopes that with Reagan elected, as he ultimately was, and, you know, with this 10-year history now of not getting their issues addressed, they would go into negotiations with Reagan, having said, we endorsed you, and Reagan made promises to them that he would address their issues.
Well, and that's an amazing part of the story right there, that they endorsed the president who ended up destroying them.
It's such a deep irony, and believe me, the controllers themselves, you know, this has been a thing that causes them special anger because they feel like they were betrayed, that promises were made that were not kept. And really, they went into their negotiation with Reagan knowing that in their back pocket they had built a strike capacity. They'd taken a couple of years and really educated their members and said, look, it's illegal to strike in the federal government, but the only illegal strike really is an unsuccessful strike. They pointed back at their sick out in 1970. They said, we got some positive changes by doing that. They pointed to the fact that in 1970, postal workers, over 300,000 of them, also federal employees, went on strike, and none of them were fired, and they won important things. And the lesson that they drew from that and from other public sector strikes in the 70s, teacher strikes, others, sometimes illegal, was that you had to be willing to engage in civil disobedience of this kind sometimes if you were going to get your employer to deal fairly with you. So they went into the negotiation feeling that they'd been promised these things. Reagan owed them, in effect, but if he didn't, deliver, they would, you know, force the issue with a strike. The negotiations proved to be disappointing. They did feel like they were let down by this guy they endorsed. And so they went on, they took a strike vote, and they walked out on the morning of August 3rd, 1981.
All right, I want to hear the rest of the story, but we're going to take a short break, and I just want to let listeners know that we're talking about the 40th anniversary of the PATCO strike with Professor Joseph McCartan, who wrote the book on the strike called Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. This is Ethan Elkind. You're listening to Your Call, and we'll be back right after this short break. All right. For those of you just joining us, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who'll be back tomorrow. And this is Your Call. Today, we're talking about the legacy of the Reagan administration's anti-union tactics. 40 years ago, 13,000 members of PATCO went on strike. That's the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization. And 2 days later, former President Ronald Reagan fired 11,345 air traffic controllers. And this Sunday, September 19th, is the anniversary of the Solidarity March on Washington, which was organized by labor leaders in support of that strike. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or sending an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Or you can reach us via Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. And we're very pleased to be joined by Professor Joseph McCartan, who wrote the book on the strike called Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. So, Professor McCartan, you were talking about the lead up to the strike and what was happening. And after the air traffic controllers walked out, around 7,000 flights across the country were canceled, which really sent a huge message. And so what was it like once the strike went down? What were the conditions for federal workers, for the air traffic controllers, and for customers and pilots and those involved in the airline industry?
People saw the strike coming. The federal government was preparing for it, actually, for months. And so while PATCO prepared a strike option, the government was preparing to break the strike. And actually, strike-breaking preparations began during the Carter administration. So when the strike actually happened, it's not like the government was caught by surprise. They had trained a group of former controllers who'd moved up into supervisory ranks. They'd retrained them to go back into the towers on the radar screens. The military loaned controllers and others were rushed through training to help to try to break the strike. Nonetheless, air travel was cut immediately in half in the country. Now, the controllers thought there's no way the government could sustain this over any long period of time, so they're going to have to come back to us with a better offer. Reagan, however, within hours of the strike beginning, walked into the Rose Garden and said, "You either return to work in 48 hours or you're permanently fired. We're never going to hire you back. You're never going to return to these jobs." The controllers thought, well, you know, this is a bluff. They won't be able to make the system work without us. One thing the controllers didn't prepare for was the level of cooperation that developed between the Reagan administration and the nation's airlines. The airlines supported the administration during this, even though flights were cut in half, and their profits suffered. But one reason that they were prepared to do this, as I explain in the book, was that they were just a few years into the regime of deregulation of American airlines, and a lot of the airlines were in need of going through restructuring their routes and things related to that. And they actually sort of baked into their plans the idea that there would be a shutdown for a while, and they stuck with the government's position. The controllers didn't realize this would happen. They thought after the 48-hour deadline passed, well, maybe 2 weeks, a month later, you know, the administration would have enough and would come up with a compromise response that has happened back in 1970. But it just didn't happen. And, you know, one of the things that I've argued about the strike, which is that the key decision here was what the administration decided to do, not within hours of the strike beginning, because I think even Jimmy Carter would have threatened to fire them. But what happened a month, 2 months, 3 months later, when it became clear that the strike could not succeed, and yet the administration determined on an approach to the strike then that was merciless. It was the official position that no one who stayed out would ever be taken back, and they pursued that position with a passion, and they, people who claimed that they were sick, for example, on the day of the strike, and they couldn't have come to work even if they wanted. It didn't matter. If you weren't there, you were fired, and that's it. And it was the message that came out of that, I think, that really was sort of a green light to business that, you know, you can be hard line now. And Reagan showed the way to do it, and many other private employers
seemed,
did.
I think it certainly sent a message, and there's, and it comes through in your book, just the vindictiveness to some extent of the sort of revenge on those workers who went out on strike. But can you just discuss a bit about what they were asking for specifically? I mean, you mentioned safety, higher pay, but they also wanted a reduced work week, and their president, PATCO's president, Bob Poley, stated that nearly 90% of the workforce didn't stay in their jobs long enough to retire due to the job's brutal stresses. So can you describe a bit about their conditions and what they were hoping to get out of the strike?
Yeah, a lot of controllers were forced into early retirement because they couldn't pass the physicals that you had to undergo on a regular basis because of the stress. The toll the stress was taking on them. So one thing they wanted was a shorter work week. They wanted improved equipment, but they did also want a wage increase. And at one point in the bargaining process, they had demanded a $10,000 wage increase across the board for every controller. Now, that's the thing that, you know, unions often in a bargaining situation will put a demand on the table to just, you know, be a big bargaining chip at the beginning that they're prepared to whittle down, and they certainly would have been. But having put that demand on the table, the Reagan people went and made that the and portrayed that as though that was the bottom line of what the controllers were after. And he did that at a time that a recession was beginning to take hold. It would be known as the Reagan recession. And in which many, you know, workers would say, looking at this, what, a $10,000 increase? I mean, I haven't gotten that much of an increase over 10 years in the job I'm in. So the controllers did not prepare well for the battle for public opinion. A lot of the things that they were after just got, you know, overshadowed.
Certainly, it seems like they lost that battle pretty quickly and
very
really
quickly.
Really did rally to President Reagan's ultimatum against them. I wanted to go to our listeners now. We have a caller, Robert, from San Francisco, who's on the line. So, Robert, welcome to your call.
Yes. My question is more or less, where do we go from here? You have a company like Amazon, which when their workers try to organized, they were so heavily retaliated against, not in an underhanded manner, but right above board, all the way into their bathrooms. They had no relief. A weekend NLRB, OSHA, which is kept out most of the time, except for California. So my question is once again, where do you go from here? The postal strike at this time, it had massive support of the public.
Thank you, Robert, for raising this important question. I think this is a big part of the sort of concluding section of Professor McCartan's book, but I'm interested in your response to Robert's take on where organized labor goes from here. Where do workplace practices go from here?
Well, that's right, Robert. Robert's exactly right and is asking the right question. Where do we go from here? Well, there are lessons to be drawn from what happened to PATCO. One of them relates to what I was just saying before Robert's question, and that is how the union went about what it did. Unfortunately for PATCO, there are reasons for this, but unfortunately for them, this was a strike of people by themselves, for themselves, for the most part. And what I mean by that is they never really sought solidarity with other workers and unions prior to the walkout, and The demands they made were framed in such a way, as I just mentioned about the pay increase, that they could be portrayed as selfish, as Reagan tried to portray them. They did not take an approach that I think unions in recent years have done very effectively in the public sector, that is, in a thing called bargaining for the common good, where teachers' unions, you've seen the L.A. teachers have done this, Oakland teachers have done this, Chicago teachers' unions, if they are engaging in a contract campaign, the first thing they do is reach out to the community to build alliances with parents and other groups and incorporate into the demands they bring into collective bargaining, demands that support the community's investment in the schools, et cetera. And so one thing we have to do, I think, especially because we've seen the decline of numbers of workers in unions, is that those who are unionized need to frame their struggles in a way that they are linking up to the needs of unorganized workers, and unorganized workers can feel a stake in the success of organized workers. And so that's one key thing. But that has to do with workers who are already in unions. Those who are not, Robert uses the example of the Amazon workers. I think one thing we've seen is that the process by which workers have to form unions in this country is completely broken. The Amazon strike shows how employers, or not the Amazon strike, but the Amazon organizing campaign in Bessemer, shows how employers are able to exploit the weakness of that system and break the law, knowingly break the law at times. Amazon's fine to have a redo of that election. They'll break the law again and force another one, perhaps, and wear down workers and wear down the unions that are trying to break through. And that's where I think we have to return to the idea of collective action. As maybe even needing to precede union formation, that we have to find ways of workers being able to come together, demonstrate in some way their own power to each other as well as to their boss, as a way of building solidarity and being able to activate people to be able to wage strikes. If we're simply waiting to go through an NLRB process to cast a vote, there are too many ways to break apart solidarity in that. So that's, I think, another lesson of this moment.
And NLRB, of course, refers to the National Labor Relations Board. Well, thank you, Robert, for calling in with that question. And to your point, Professor McCartan, we have an email from a listener who asks, any thoughts or comments on teacher strikes? My union, the Oakland Education Association, went on strike in February 2019 for about a week or so. The settlement was better, although not great. So how do teacher strikes fit into the larger union context?
Well, I think teachers in recent years have been just leading the way and showing the way to revive the strike in the United States. And that Oakland effort that your emailer refers to, I think, was an important effort. It didn't win everything, as the writer points out, but it was a step in the right direction. And in the Oakland situation, they did employ some of these bargaining for the common good approaches, strengthening alliances between Oakland teachers in the community whose students they teach. So I think teachers are crucial, absolutely crucial. And in fact, in 2018, the year when we saw the Red for Ed movement spreading in a lot of states, teachers represented more than 80% of all strikers that engaged in strikes as registered by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, at least as registered in major work stoppages. And almost single-handedly, the struggles of teachers in Oakland and the upheaval that happened in West Virginia in 2018 and the UTLA in L.A., Chicago Teachers Union, I think they're showing a new generation how to use strikes, how to prepare for them, how to build support for them. And I think that's absolutely essential. At the time that the PATCO workers went out on strike in 1981, you could look back at the previous two decades, and each of those decades, in the 70s and the 60s, both, the U.S. averaged over 280 strikes per year, or work stoppages per year, that involved at least 100 or at least 1,000 workers each. So 280 per year. Last year in the U.S., the number was 8. So what has happened over time is that, you know, there used to be a body of knowledge and a body of experience widely shared among workers and unions about how to wage and win strikes. But in the aftermath of PATCO, that body of experience, that body of knowledge, that belief that, you know, we can win when we stand together was gradually and gradually diminished. And I think teachers played a key role to revive it. Yeah.
Well, an interesting point about the kind of crossover between public sector union strategies and tactics and private sector unions. And you write that unionized government workers were on the rise, and public employees unions in particular had really been their happiest and most flourishing since the New Deal. And the public sector union membership jumped tenfold between the mid-50s and the mid-70s. It was very strong leading up to the PATCO strike. But I'm wondering if you can explain a bit of what the differences are between a public sector union and a private sector union. I mean, it seems to me that the nature of your employer is very different when you have a public sector union that can essentially influence elections, that can determine who they're bargaining with, versus a private sector union where you have an entity outside of the government that seems to have very different kind of levers of accountability over them. Does that change how these unions strategize or the makeup of the unions? How would you describe those differences?
Well, I think one key difference, because in the case of public sector workers, you could argue that in the end, the employer is the taxpayer, that there always has to be a sensitivity to that. And so there's a burden, I think, that public workers bear that they have to be aware of, and that is that they have to be able to justify what they want as in the interest of the common good, and in the interest of good services, in the interest of well-functioning government. And it's not hard for public sector unions to make those cases, because those are such essential services, teaching, for example. But you have to be aware to make that case. It's also the case in the public sector where there might need to be less freedom to strike than exists in a private sector context, because some government services to suspend them could be threatening to people, dangerous for people.
Absolutely. We saw that here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We had a BART strike that really crippled our transportation network. And so I think your point about the difference between government services versus private services is a really critical one. I didn't mean to cut you off, but we have a couple callers waiting, and I wanted to give them a chance to weigh in. So we have Sherry dialing in from Berkeley. Sherry, thanks for joining the conversation here.
Oh, thank you very much. This is a long overdue discussion about what happened in 1970. I know that if you talk to anybody over a certain age, they always say that we're in this predicament today because of what Reagan did to the air controllers. First, I want to take issue with the fact that it sounds like, you know, you said that the workers need to justify how what they're doing is in the interest of the public good. As long as Bezos and Zuckerberg and the billionaires and the millionaires that are basically exploiting workers, as long as they're you hold them to the same standard, which I wasn't getting a sense of. And with the air controllers, the fact that they put $10,000 on the table is no big deal. And the way it came across to me, it's like you're kind of, well, they shouldn't have asked for that much because, you know, well, wait a minute. If you look at the workers today, if you take the minimum wage in 1970 and adjust it for inflation today, the minimum wage in San Francisco would be close to $30. And so this living wage of 15 is like nobody can really in the Bay Area live on $15 an hour. So there's this, you know, what I see it, I call it incrementalism. Like we have to ask for little tiny things and go slowly. And I just wonder back in, when we were fighting for the 8-hour day, of course I wasn't around then, were those workers saying, well, let's, instead of working 16, let's just ask for 15 hours a day and then go to 14. No, they went for the 8-hour because that was what was needed. That was what they deserved. That was what they demanded, and that's what they got.
All right. Well, Sherry, these are great questions. Let me give Professor McCartan a chance to weigh in because we only have a few minutes left on the program. But Professor McCartan, your response.
Yeah, actually, Sherry, I think I agree with what you're saying. And I think part of our problem right now is we're not being bold enough regarding what we need to improve the situation for workers in this country. I agree with you. $15 an hour is just not enough. Maybe when that demand was first placed on the table, now it's a number of years ago, it's like 8 or 9 years now we've been asking for $15. That might have made a difference, but increasingly that's just not enough either. So I think boldness is exactly what we need right now. But I think that boldness needs to be matched with shrewdness and with an understanding of, you know, the fact that we have to build a case and bring people along with us. I don't mean to say the controllers were wrong in what they asked for in 10,000, but you have to also be aware of how your opponents will cast you. And you have to, I think, be ahead of the game. And I think I would say that teacher unions in recent years have done a good job of not finding themselves in that box, but preparing to wage what have often been, in recent years, pretty successful fights.
And thank you, Sherry, for dialing in with that. I wanted to go to some current legislation now and get your take on it, Professor McCartan. So right now a bill is waiting for a vote in the Senate called the PRO Act, otherwise known as the Protect the Right to Organize Act. Can you just explain briefly what you think of this bill and why you think it could be really important for workers today?
I think it could be really important in lowering some of those barriers that Amazon's recent campaign against the Bessemer workers showed really, you know, make it hard to form a union. The PRO Act will make it easier. And Lord knows we've needed an act like this for a long time. We haven't had a major amendment to our federal labor law and the right to organize and how it is, you know, dealt with since 1947. And that was a bad amendment, the Taft-Hartley Act. Really, we're resting our 21st century workplace and workers' fates on a law that the Wagner Act that was passed in 1935. We need a thorough upgrading of our law. The PRO Act is a really important fix. But actually, I would go back to what Sherry said earlier and say, actually, maybe we need to even be bolder than what the PRO Act is asking for. For one thing, it doesn't deal with the problems of farm workers who have never been covered by federal law. There are a bunch of things that are broken, and I think we need to recognize just how systemic the failure is of us being able to protect worker power in this country.
Well, we'll have to keep an eye on it. Let's go to just one last caller here before we have to end. We have Patrick dialing in from Costa Mesa.
Hi, I want to appreciate what you're doing in terms of educating people. I think that we need to go back to some of the references the professor made, not just to the Taft-Hartley law, but I don't think that there was the solidarity in the labor movement that we needed, in particular the air traffic controllers needed in order to win a fight against somebody as dangerous as Reagan. You have a situation where we had the deregulation of the trucking industry and the airlines that came in under the guidance of Jimmy Carter and Teddy Kennedy. It came in 1979, and it really, really shifted the balance of power in the trucking and the airline industry, and it laid the groundwork for deunionization, which has occurred, particularly in the trucking sector. It laid that groundwork.
All right, well, let's. Sorry to interrupt, but we only have a couple minutes, so I just want to give Professor McCartan a chance to weigh in. But thank you for that. Professor McCartan, thoughts?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's a really smart observation. And the war against unions and collective bargaining that we've seen over the past 40-plus years wouldn't have been so successful had it not had some bipartisan elements to it. And unfortunately, as he cites in the example of airline and trucking deregulation, it was often Democrats who were thinking that by deregulating these industries, we'd get lower prices, but not thinking much about the fact we'd also get lower wages and horrible working conditions for a lot of the people working in those sectors. And sure enough, this is one of the things that's occurred.
All right, well, we just have 30 seconds left. So, Professor McCartan, any final thoughts about where you think we're going to be going next, what you're keeping an eye on, particularly with the Biden administration in power now, a pro-union administration?
Well, I think one thing is Biden's recent statements on behalf of workers and unions are sort of a counterpoint to the Reagan era. We've still got a long way to go, but just as he closed down the Afghanistan war, I think you could also say he might have brought an end to the Reagan era, finally. Now we have to build a fight to shape what comes after it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank all of our listeners for listening and dialing in. And I want to thank Professor Joseph McCartan, author of the book Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. Professor McCartan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ethan.
Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows, visit yourcallradio.org, and you can find us on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks so much to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr, our studio engineer today. I'm Ethan Elkind. Rose Aguilar will be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Your Call.